They're utilizing AI to go through and not just execute commands or build command playbooks for themselves, but also to go through and plan out the full attack. An adversary that used to move at a speed of like, you know, 1 month can now move at a speed of 1 day.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, weekly Intel chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. Hello, Matt Bromley. How you doing today, sir?
Hey, Chris. I'm doing well. I am back in Texas. I think I was back last week too, but definitely back here now and looking forward to chat with you today, man. We got a little bit of a heat wave going on down here. I don't know why, but it's made me like have a super good pep in my step, if you will. we are hitting 70 degrees, 80 degrees Fahrenheit in the last week of February. For those of you who need to translate that into Celsius, whatever that number is, it's warm for this time of year. I was just in summer in Australia, and now I'm back in like Australia's versions of summer in Texas. So, man, I got nothing to complain about. I'm happy. It's warm and work is good and I'm having fun. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. We had a bit of frost on the ground yesterday, but I'm feeling confident and planted my peas. So,
okay.
Really excited about that. You know, my dream is to end my days in my garden, and peas are great because my kids eat them. Yeah. So it's good stuff all around.
Nice. That's awesome. I didn't know peas were a late winter vegetable. This is
they like to be planted when it's still a little bit cold, but you know, you don't want to jump the gun because like a deep frost will kill them.
Yeah.
But I want to get them out early and start eating those snap peas because it's delicious.
Because they're good, right? Awesome.
Because they're good. Yeah. and nothing like getting your hands in the dirt. If you spend your day in front of a computer and most of the evenings like I do, and I'm sure Matt does as well, it's nice to go out there and just get your hands in the dirt and remember sort of where we came from, I guess.
100%. Touch ground as often as you can.
That's it. All right. We got some interesting stuff today. This first one definitely made me think of you when I was putting it in. So GitLab's threat intelligence team published detailed findings on North Korean activity associated with the Contagious Interview campaign and broader IT worker operations. Contagious Interview, active since at least 2022, involves North Korean actors posing as recruiters and persuading software developers to run malicious code under the pretense of technical interviews. These projects deploy custom malware that steals credentials and enables remote control of victim systems, facilitating financial theft, identity theft, and lateral movement. In 2025, GitLab identified and banned accounts tied to this activity, leveraging visibility into repositories to track infrastructure, malware artifacts, and operational records. GitLab states there is no action required by customers and that its platform remains secure. During 2025, GitLab banned 131 accounts attributed to North Korean malware distribution, averaging 11 bans per month. Activity accelerated in the second half of the year and peaked in September. The actors primarily use JavaScript code bases, with over 95% of observed malware linked to Beavertail and Otter cookie families, along with a compiled ClickFix Beavertail variant identified in September. In more than 80% of cases, repositories contain loaders rather than full payloads, pulling malware from remote infrastructure hosted on legitimate services such as Vercel, as well as custom domains. Techniques evolved over time, including malicious NPM dependencies and execution through VS Code tasks. A common execution chain involved Base64 encoding, encoded staged URLs stored in .env files, trigger functions and fetch remote content, and custom error handlers using function.constructor to execute retrieve code. GitLab assesses that multiple distinct teams operated in parallel with limited coordination. The report includes four case studies. The first details a North Korean IT worker cell managed by Kil Nam Kang, almost certainly operating from Beijing. Financial records from Q1 2022 to Q3 2025 show earnings of approximately $1.64 million against a $1.88 million target. The cell, composed of seven additional members, generated revenue through freelance software development under false identities, Records included personal dossiers, passports, banking data tied to Chinese institutions, and structured quarterly performance reports. Documentation suggests tight hierarchical oversight and collective living arrangements with ideological and financial performances tracked. GitLab banned accounts associated with this activity. Additional case studies examine a synthetic identity pipeline used to create at least 135 personas, an operator controlling 21 stolen identities, and a fake IT worker likely operating from central Moscow. The synthetic identity cluster automated scraping images, generating face passports using Verif tools, removing watermarks via Photoshop automation, and creating accounts to obtain work. The group gained access to at least 48 private code bases and maintained over 73,000 leads in a database. Another operator altered U.S. identity documents by inserting their own photograph and possessed personal data from nearly 8,000 employees of a U.S. hospitality company. The Moscow-based actor used AI-generated headshots and recruited facilitators to host laptops for remote access, later gaining employment with a U.S. technology agency and accessing privileged systems across cases. GitLab disrupted accounts, improved clustering and infrastructure detection, and shared over 600 indicators of compromise to assist defenders. Quite the operation going on and quite the breakdown of how these things work. Definitely worth taking a look at if you think this is something your organization might be dealing with. And I think a lot of them are. I'm pretty sure Lima Charlie's had a few people apply that were suspect.
So we've covered this actually many times, Chris, on this podcast. And it's one of those situations where it's a long running campaign. It's been going on for a while. This is a lot of great insight into what just GitLab saw. And you got to think, and no offense to GitLab, but this is a subset of the operation in general, right? It's not to say that they're not using other code repository sites. And every blog post about a thing is always limited to the visibility of the publishers who made that thing. And first off, I just want to say for anyone who may be paying attention and is reading the links that Chris posts as part of the notes, and I highly recommend doing it. This blog post starts and it's capped off at a 96-minute read to get into here. A significant majority of that is a character count based in the IOCs. And I just want to let folks know that, like, you definitely want to read your way through this. It is a fantastic article. Really goes in deep into the contagious interview campaign. I love the research GitLab did here into kind of how they work, the different code that they use, how the staging infrastructure is set up. There's so many really, really cool and interesting things here. Tons of IOCs that you could integrate into a detection workflow if you need to. But Chris, the other thing I think it does or it adds into here really is just goes into depth of kind of how this campaign operates. You know, one of the things that we have stressed a lot here as we've talked about some of these different campaigns has been, if it wasn't successful, adversaries likely wouldn't do it, or they wouldn't do it for so long. The fact that it's been in motion here since, I think, 2022, they call out, so 4 years of tracking, or 3 years and change that this has been tracked, that it's been going on. They're talking about, you know, massive repositories, multiple spreadsheets, with, you know, deposits and withdrawals from virtual accounts. They're talking about the links to Chinese financial organizations and things like that. There is all sorts of information copied in here. And I just love the level of depth that the GitLab team went into, number one. I'm also a really big fan of the IOCs that were provided. And I know I mentioned earlier that it's a super lengthy list of IOCs, but it goes into like estimative language, which I thought was actually pretty cool. That's one thing that we don't usually see in the posts that we cover and how that works, right? Estimated probability to assessments. I think that's pretty cool. We also use words like possible and may, where we're unable to provide an estimate. And I thought that was actually like really a cool thing. You don't see that a lot. And then getting into the different IOCs, and we've got, you know, emails on emails and infrastructure and Vercel.app links, all sorts of insider information. Just love the level of technical detail here. And the thing that I contrast this to, Chris, is we cover a lot of blog posts. We cover a lot of information that is like really good stories, but very little technical actionable stuff. And for anyone here who's at an organization where you feel like you may have been targeted by this, or you're like, hey, I want to understand more about how this threat group does what it does, definitely check out this post, number one, but then read through how the adversaries go through and do this. You know, what I don't think folks realize, and some of the things that we've talked about before, Chris, is the level of AI usage that goes into these. We're talking complete face masking, AI assisted interviews and code generation and all sorts of stuff. I mean, it literally is an entirely AI front, but there is a human behind all of that obfuscation who's actually doing the talking and stuff. And it's a very technically heavy and borderline technically impressive threat. It's a significant one, but there's so much leaning on tech that it makes it very tough for organizations to discern if they don't have good measures in place. So the other thing I would offer to our listeners here is read through this type of thing and then use this in your user education. And remember, security team, defenders listening here, your user education needs to also extend to the developer team, those folks who are interviewing these highly sensitive individuals. You know, they've got to know how to look for some of these telltale signs as well.
Yeah, and I would, for any defenders looking at this too, I would take note of the way that they're loading payloads. They're doing quite a few clever things that are hidden in like config files and error handling and stuff like that. And I think that's, you know, something that probably sneak past a lot of folks unless you're specifically kind of paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, violent agreement there as well.
All right. Next up, a financially motivated Russian-speaking threat actor used generative AI tools to compromise more than 600 Fortinet FortiGate firewall instances between January and February, according to Amazon Web Services. The affected devices were distributed across more than 55 countries with concentrations in South Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, West Africa, and Northern Europe. Notably, researchers observed no exploitation of FortiGate software vulnerabilities. Instead, the campaign relied on exposed management ports and weak credentials protected only by single-factor authentication. AWS emphasized that the activity demonstrates how AI can enable an otherwise unsophisticated actor to exploit fundamental security gaps at scale. CJ Moses, Chief Information Security Officer of Amazon Integrated Security, stated that the actor was not associated with any known advanced persistent threat group and likely operated as an individual or small group. Despite limited technical sophistication, the attacker used generative AI services throughout every phase of operations. AI-assisted workflows enabled network reconnaissance through custom-built tooling, generation of step-by-step exploitation instructions, organized and prioritized task trees, and development of Python scripts for both pre- and post-exploitation activities. The primary access vector involves scanning internet-exposed management interfaces over ports 443, 8443, 10443 and 4443, then leveraging commonly reused credentials to gain entry. Once access was established, the attacker targeted configuration files containing administration credentials, firewall policies, and network topology data. AI-assisted Python scripts were used to parse, decrypt, and organize stolen configuration data. The campaign extended into compromised Active Directory environments, with the attacker extracting credentials and backup infrastructure details. Veeam backup and replication servers were specifically targeted because they often store elevated credentials and play a critical role in recovery operations. Post-exploitation activity, including lateral movement and domain compromise, relied on established open-source offensive tools. When resistance was encountered, the actor reportedly shifted to softer targets rather than persisting. AWS framed the campaign as a cautionary example for defenders. The success of the operation stemmed from exposed management interfaces, weak or default credentials, and lack of multi-factor authentication. Recommended mitigations include removing FortiGate management interfaces from direct internet exposure or restricting them to known IP ranges, rotating default and SSL VPN credentials, auditing VPN logs for anomalous geographic access, and implementing MFA for administrative and VPN accounts. Organizations are also advised to monitor for unexpected DC sync operations, suspicious scheduled tasks, unauthorized access to backup credential stores, and newly created accounts designed to blend with legitimate users. Damon Small of Xscape noted that AI-driven spray and pray approaches will likely become more common due to operational scale that AI tools provide. So yeah, sorry to pick on Fortinet all the time, but this one was definitely worth talking about. And when I read through it, I just see lots of like bad security practices. Like, none of this stuff should go through, starting with MFA, right?
Yeah, Chris, reading through this, I wasn't sure to say, hey, Fortinet, it's good to see you again. Or, hey, AI, yeah, good to see you again. I wasn't sure which one to lean into there, but I'll just say I'd like to focus on the AI portion here. Fortinet, good to see you again. And I say that somewhat sarcastically and very facetiously. Unfortunately, another FortiGate issue. But I think the real focus here is, at least the way that I'm interpreting it, is just the level of AI involvement here. You know, Chris, if you were to go through and read kind of general AI sentiment over on the internet, it ranges from force multiplier, this is awesome, all the way to, can we stop talking about this because no one is using this successfully? I don't know what rock those folks are living under, to be honest with you. I immediately started to have more appreciable, necessary success with use of AI in my daily workload. If that individual has not seen those things, then I don't know, like hit us up separately or something like that. I feel like some folks' exposure to AI has been very limited to people vibe coding an unnecessary app and be like, oh, cool, look at what I did, as opposed to like, here's how this actually augments my daily workflow.
Or they tried it 12 months ago and it wasn't awesome.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Or
they use it like Google and they're like, yeah, oh, I use AI like a search engine. This is crap because it hallucinates. And I'm like, that's not its purpose. The reason I'm kind of introducing it this way is there are people out there who are utilizing it as a force multiplication attribute or asset under their belt. And I think this is an example here. I don't know the threat group. By the way, welcome Amazon Threat Intelligence to the chat. Great to have you.
Yes.
Haven't interacted with you guys before in this podcast. But one of the things that they've called out is how the adversary basically had an AI-generated workflow from top to bottom. And the thing I want to point out, whenever someone goes on and talks about AI being a force multiplier, or AI being a threat, this is what they're referring to. You know, Chris, and I'm on a little bit of a soapbox here because we've got RSA coming up and there's a lot of folks starting to posture their talks and posture their ideas for RSA discussions. And I'm seeing this intentional kind of polarization, maybe subtle polarization of AI, where there's people who are like, I'm giving a talk on how the world is being consumed by AI slop and how awful this thing is and whatnot. And then I'm seeing folks who are kind of like, you know, AI is not going to be the threat that everyone thinks it is. And you can tell which camp I'm clearly in, right? Not between those two, but I'm clearly in the pro AI camp. But I just want to zoom in on articles like this. Chris, I don't know if this adversary would have had the ability to have executed this entire framework without AI. And this is what I think the topic of conversation should be, of like how adversaries use it. Here's an individual or a threat group that, as of right now, we don't know who they are. So I'm speaking with not too much certainty or confidence in who this is here. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say this individual, this person, this threat group, whoever they are, likely would not have been able to achieve the same level of developmental success as they did. I'm not saying they achieved success in attacks, but I don't think they would have been able to build out this infrastructure as well as they have without utilizing generative AI across the board. And AWS goes through and they identify every single step. But looking at, like, you know, lateral movement and backup infrastructure targeting and limited exploitation success and some of the key things that were called out from a post-exploitation perspective and whatnot, they're utilizing AI to go through and not just execute commands or build command playbooks for themselves, but also to go through and plan out the full attack, right? Mm-hmm. Quick pivotal changes in the operational workflow and then generating tools based, or I should say AI generating tools at scale. I don't think this adversary would have been able to do this at the same speed without generative AI. And if you take anything away from an article like this, it's got to be an adversary that used to move at a speed of, like, you know, 1 month can now move at a speed of 1 day. That doesn't mean AI is going to take over red teaming or every adversary is now a Claude bot in disguise or something like that, Chris. But what it does is it just goes to show that with the right level of prompting, because one of the first things I thought when I read this article was, I thought you couldn't do this with AI. And that's no dig at any company. That is more a yes, you can, right? All malware is software. Sorry, not all software is malware, but all malware is software. And
yes,
I can ask AI to build a piece of software, and it's not until I use the thing maliciously that it becomes malware, right?
Yeah.
Quick example, PS Exec. Y'all can interpret that any way you want. If you've been a Windows admin before, is PS Exec malware? I know a handful of people who would say absolutely not. I know a handful of people who would say it absolutely is. It's subjective.
Yeah.
We need to have a approach and a thought process towards the, how AI is being utilized from a threat actor perspective. And to me, this is a perfect example of legitimate change in the threat landscape. An adversary can move through different phases faster than they could have before. And the moment you operationalize a threat actor in a positive way, meaning they can move faster, they can build more tools, they can scale, they can plan, they can do different levels of obfuscation, so on and so forth, is the moment they start to level up. And here's what it means, Chris. If they go and find a vulnerable FortiGate appliance out there, they're able to move faster. For folks who have a somewhat, you know, highly negative opinion of AI, I dare you to go to the organizations that have been impacted by this threat actor and talk to the C-suite and say, ah, well, this guy's just a junkie using AI to be faster. You know, this isn't really an industry threat. Walk into the middle of that incident management room for an organization that's having to combat this, and they will disagree with you. And this is where I think defenders, those I'm speaking out to our audience here, defenders, this is where we need to all be aligned on. It allows adversaries to move faster, semicolon. It also allows defenders to move faster. So lean into it as much as you can and do exactly the same stuff that adversaries are doing. Use it to scale operations, use it to get insight faster. And I view a lot of positivity in this article, Chris, because for any blue teamer out there who's like, I don't really know if AI is going to be impactful or not, if they can use it to force multiply, so can you.
And I'll just add too, I know like a lot of the frontier models have put a lot of effort into, you know, safety constraints that won't let threat actors get certain types of information out of the models. Recently, I was made available of a gentleman named Pliny the Liberator. I found him on Twitter and watched what he's doing, breaking the models. It's wild. He's able to get Claude or ChatGPT and any of these leading models to like basically give them instructions on how to build bioweapons and nuclear weapons and stuff like that. So, you know, he's doing that as an example to show that you can break through this. But I'm sure that people that operate on the dark side of things all know about these sort of hacks to get through and to get that information out. So as much as we try and make these LLMs safe from threat actors using them, they're going to figure out how to do it. And I just don't think that technology really has a way to completely stop people. You're going to stop most of the people that kind of half-ass it and try.
Right.
But like if somebody's determined to get through and get some malicious knowledge out of there, they're going to be able to leverage this stuff.
And not to belabor this point, Chris, but this whole sentiment runs true with, like, I've worked with many folks in the past, and we've kind of seen adversarial infrastructure fail. We've seen adversary tools fail. And basically, like, I can remember a day when during incident response, you would encounter kind of half-baked malware. Mm-hmm. And you'd encounter, like, half-baked scripts and be like, oh, wow, the adversary didn't really think this one through, you know, and that kind of stuff. And now they have an ability to cover those additional bases, right? Like they kind of, okay, AI can help them be a little bit smarter. So if anything, it takes weaker adversaries and then like levels the playing field a little bit, right? In an odd way, number one. But then to your point is when adversaries can then figure out how to get around the guardrails and do all that kind of stuff, you know, what's to stop, and I'm going to throw some tooling out here for anyone on the blue team who's listening, what's to stop an adversary from throwing detailed output from Bloodhound or Sharphound into an AI and just being like, hey, explain this to me in layman's terms. And it's probably already been done before. I'm sure it's been done before. And like the thing there is, you know, someone somewhere is going to be like, oh, AI is not going to replace Bloodhound. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking someone to take technical output and break it down into a way that they can understand it better, and then they can act accordingly to that. That capability didn't exist a while ago. And where I'm going with this, Chris, is like, okay, Matt, how does that level up adversaries, right? Well, now they understand more about domain weaknesses, right? Now they can start to think out of the box more. And to your point, now they can start to abuse the prompts a little bit, ask very targeted, specific questions. And the next thing you know, an adversary can take highly technical output, break it down into layman's terms, find ways through the data to figure out a weakness or a vulnerability, and then say to AI, hey, this path is great. Go ahead and code this thing for me. Here's a Python script that does this stuff with hard-coded variables inside of it and whatnot. And they find a direct route through to get to somewhere. It doesn't mean, you know, every red teamer in the world is out of a job, but it does act as a multiplier. And then with what Chris is talking about, if an adversary can start to bend the usage of LLMs a little bit, now they have a really functional member of their team. And I think this gets lost a lot because a lot of folks, I don't know, Chris, and I'll get off this horse in just a moment. You can tell you've tapped into something here. But I saw someone the other day who's a pretty loud voice on LinkedIn, and maybe that's as far as it goes. But they threw out this assessment of like, you know, in the past year of using LLMs, I have never generated anything useful. And I'm like, in a year of using LLMs, you haven't generated anything useful? Dude, no offense.
I've got three things this morning.
No offense, man. But like, yeah. Go and see what adversaries are doing and then define usefulness. I'm so confused about how the value to both sides isn't being seen here, because threat actors mm-hmm. are certainly seeing value. And again, it's not a complete automation of the toolkit. It's having insight they didn't have before. Like, that's enough, I think. Anyways, yeah. Slash rant yeah. over.
Yeah, I'm going to move on because the last article, we're going to come back to this Uh-oh. In a big way. I want to save some of that fuel. So this one, Cisco has released emergency patches for a critical zero-day vulnerability in its Catalyst SD-WAN products that have been actively exploited in the wild. The flaw tracked as CVE-2026-20127 and assigned a CVSS score of 10 out of 10 affects the peering authentication mechanism in Catalyst SD-WAN controller, formerly vSmart, and Catalyst SD-WAN manager, formerly vManage. The vulnerability allows unauthenticated remote attackers to send crafted requests that bypass authentication and gain administrative privileges. Yikes. Successful exploitation results in access as an internal high-privileged non-root user, which can then be used to access netconf and manipulate configuration across SD-WAN fabric. Cisco has addressed the issue in Catalyst SD-WAN. There's a bunch of versions if you want to read them, find them in the article. The company acknowledged limited in the wild exploitation and published indicators of compromise to assist organizations in identifying malicious activity targeting internet exposed systems. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, added CVE-2026-20127 to its known exploited vulnerability or KEV catalog and issued Emergency Directive 26-03 requiring federal agencies to patch within 2 days. Yikes. So they're taking this seriously. CISA also added that CVE, a high severity path. Another CVE, -2022-20775. I'm trying to avoid reading all the big numbers. A high severity path traversal vulnerability disclosed in September of 2022 to the KEV catalog as well. That flaw enables authenticated attackers to execute arbitrary commands with root privileges. According to CISA and partner agencies in the Five Eyes Alliance, threat actors have chained both of these together to bypass authentication, escalate privileges to root, and establish persistence on vulnerable systems. After creating an administrative account through the zero-day, attackers reportedly downgrade the software to a version susceptible to the older flaw to maintain root-level access. Cisco Talos attribute the attacks to a threat actor tracked as UAT-8616, described as highly sophisticated and active since at least 2023. Talos has not linked the activity to a known threat group or specific country. Emergency Directive 26-03 instructs agencies to inventory affected systems, ensure logs are stored externally, collect specific artifacts, and update to patch releases. Cisco also announced fixes for additional Catalyst SD-WAN manager vulnerabilities, including a critical authentication bypass in the API user authentication mechanism, along with 9 other high and medium severity issues in separate products, though none of those are known to be exploited. So yeah, the TLDR here is if you have any Cisco devices in your stack, go take a closer look.
Yeah, it wouldn't be an episode if Chris didn't give me an opportunity to say patch, patch, patch. I wouldn't think so. But yeah, I mean, folks, look, if you're running these devices, I mean, I don't really want to say much more here. Cisco put an advisory out. Hopefully, if you're running these devices, you're not surprised. Like, oh, Matt and Chris, I didn't know that was going to happen. Look, it's got a 10 score, 10 out of 10. Like, really, really big deal. Unauthenticated remote attacker authentication and gain admin privileges. Not really a situation we want to be in where you're left unpatched. Please, and I'll just remind everyone, please note that adversaries love to, like, you know, scan for vulnerable devices, wait for you to go through your patching cycle, and then come back at the tail end and compromise. So patch, patch, patch as soon as you can. Take yourself off that target list. And, you know, this isn't a thing, Chris, where, like, and I think you and I are very clear about our ideas on patching across the various episodes of this podcast. But one of the things I'll highlight here is, like, folks, this isn't an intentional thing. It's not like someone, you know, it's not like a software supply chain library where there's an adversary inserting malicious code that you then need to go and replace and fix. It's a vulnerable device that sits at the perimeter most of the time. It requires a patch. Have a patching cycle or a patching process in place and enact it. Simple, dry, to the point. Patch, patch, yep. Patch.
I want to get into this last one, and I'll just preface it with, you know, a lot of people are talking about this article. It's had a big impact across a lot of sectors. I think the truth lies somewhere between what they're writing here and the complete opposite, that everything's fine. So let's get into it. This article is by Citrini Research, and they present a forward-looking scenario framed as a June 2028 macro memo described a global intelligence crisis triggered by abundant AI-driven intelligence. The piece is explicitly labeled as a thought exercise rather than a prediction. It explores a sequence in which rapid advances in agentic AI beginning in late 2025 lead to a structural displacement of white-collar labor, margin expansion for firms, and a surge in AI investment. By October 2026, equity markets are at highs, productivity growth is strong, and nominal GDP prints mid to high single digits. However, wage growth for white-collar workers collapses as layoffs accelerate. The authors describe the emergence of a ghost GDP where output appears in national accounts but fails to circulate through the consumer economy. As AI replaces labor, income shifts towards owners of compute, velocity of money declines, and consumption weakens despite strong aggregate output. The memo outlines a negative feedback loop termed the human intelligence displacement spiral. Firms cut payroll and reinvest savings into AI, which further reduces labor demand. Early disruption appears in software, particularly SaaS, as agentic coding tools allow enterprises to replicate mid-market products internally or negotiate steep discounts. ServiceNow's reported slowdown in net new ACV growth and workforce reduction is presented as a turning point, illustrating reflexivity. Customers cutting headcount reduce seats based on revenue for vendors. AI-driven automation extends beyond software into consumer intermediation. Agentic commerce tools eliminate pricing friction, compress subscription lifetime value, reduce travel and insurance intermediation margins, and pressure payment networks by routing transactions through low-cost stablecoin rails. MasterCard slowing purchase volume growth is cited as evidence of agent-led price optimization. So that was a bunch of gobbledygook for chaining together all these sort of fall-on impacts that the article goes through. So again, it's a really interesting piece of science fiction. I don't think it reflects reality, but I'm just going to continue reading through here. So by 2027, labor market deterioration becomes visible in jolts and initiates jobless claims data. So jobless claims start going up, with white-collar job losses disproportionately affecting the top income. So basically what they're saying here is the impacts of the job losses in white-collar jobs has a wider impact on the economy as a whole, because those are the people with the most extra income to spend on services and stuff like that. So a 2% job loss in that white collar sector has like a 10 or 15% downstream impact on blue collar jobs. Mm-hmm. So they go on to say housing becomes a central concern in 2028. Prime borrowers in tech heavy regions show rising delinquencies despite strong initial underwriting as income expectations deteriorate post origination. The $13 trillion mortgage market is framed as vulnerable, not due to subprime lending, but to structural income impairment among high earners. So again, mortgages are actually seen as a very strong investment sector because they only give them to people with strong employment history and good income. But if those people start losing their jobs and having downward pressure on their income, they're already signed into these 30 years mortgages that they're not going to be able to keep up with.
Yeah.
I'll stop there. There's a little more, but the article is quite a disturbing thought exercise to run through. I had two glasses of wine after I read this last night. had a bit of a panic attack.
Yeah.
Because some of the stuff in it is stuff that I actually was thinking about, in particular, the, like, you know, a lot of people in tech are saying, well, maybe I should go get a trade and stuff like that, especially people early in their career. And it's like, okay, that's great, but, like, who hires the people in the trades to do the work for them because they're too busy with their good paying job to do the work themselves? And those are the people that are going to lose their jobs. And so there's a lot of down market impact, I think, coming.
Yeah, it's, I'm going to be honest, I'm with you, Chris. This one took a little bit of patience to read through. it's not a bad thing. It's just a really odd way to frame a prediction article, right? Yeah. It's a way to frame a prediction article where, to your point, it kind of goes and it tells the story of the impact that AI has had on the world as a result of replacing industries or streamlining industries and things like that. And it just, like, it I don't know, Chris, to me, it's kind of like a modern day, like, I don't know, War of the Worlds or something, of how, like, the world is going to crash because of all these things. And it blames a lot of it around, to your point, it blames a lot of it around lack of income stability due to the replacement of a lot of white collar jobs, that then kind of just, like, crashes down. And I don't know, Chris, to me, it's a really weird way to be like, you know, guys, did you know that everything is built on a house of cards with spit and picks? And it's like, we know this, like, look at what the pandemic of 2019 to 2022, 2023 did for most of the world, right? Like, staying indoors was a crippling thing that came about. Like, we are very much built on social interaction and people going out and spending money and stuff like that. But I mean, we had this world crippling thing that lasted for a long time. And I don't know, Chris, I mean, this is not to say that everything that came out of COVID-19 was positive. And I know for some people it's not done yet, but, like, we went through a world crippling event. Right. We went through significant job loss. We went through significant global changes and displacement, and we went through massive changes. I mean, you know, like, we went through a lot of very, very big effects. And did the world tumble and fall over? I don't really think so. We went through the 2007, 2008, and I have this particular part of the thing zoomed in particular. We went through the 2008, 2007, 2008 mortgage crisis. Like, we went through that. We went through the dot-com bubble, and I'm just quoting your and my lifetime, Chris. Like, we've gone through some of these global shifting events, and for some reason, the Earth is always about to fall out of orbit, but yet we find a way to keep going. And this is kind of the positive opinion that I took when I read this, and I was like, oh, look, another article where technology is going to completely change the world and throw it over. And I would like to remind everyone who reads this that if you were to read future looking technology articles in the 1980s. And Chris, if you were to look at sci-fi movies made in the 1980s, you and I should be teleporting back and forth to the point that we could film this episode in person and still be home in our respective geographies for dinner. And by the way, if you couldn't make it home for dinner, you would just hop in your flying vehicle and you would get there. And it's like, where's that future that we were promised,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I just, like, it's very easy to say, do you know how bad technology will get? And it's like, yeah, been here, done that. And that's not to say that some of the stuff called out in here is wrong, but it's just, yeah, to show, like, folks, please don't read everything as the Earth's about to fall apart and the entire economy is going to be disrupted. And of course, I'm taking an optimistic view here, Chris. I want to be right in this. I don't want to be at a point where AI completely replaces all white collar jobs and, you know, predictions here of significant double digit GDP losses and major credit increases and stuff like that all go up. I don't think it's going to happen here. A daisy chain of correlated bets on white collar productivity growth. Just really, I mean, I don't know. I feel like we'll find a way, you know?
One of the reassuring quotes that I heard on one of the podcasts I like to listen to They had a guest on talking about this, a financial analysis, and it was, this article could only be written by someone that employs no people, has no customers, and has never been in business before.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's a great way of framing it.
So yeah, interesting thought exercise. I mostly it caught my eye just because it actually had a measurable effect on software stocks. Like they can attribute, or somebody was attributing like a 5% reduction in the total SaaS stock investment to this article and people's gut reaction. Obviously, it's bounced back since then, but there was a dip after this article was launched.
So. Yeah. No, absolutely. So, I mean, I don't know. We'll see. It's one of those, like, I think we will see a change. I mean, to be very fair, there has been multiple industries where I think we've recognized that AI, and I'm using AI very vaguely here, could probably take over a significant portion of those industries.
Rip Stack Overflow.
Yeah, stuff, you know, there's areas where AI could certainly improve and automate stuff, but it's one of those situations where a human in the loop will never go away. You're not going to put an AI completely in front of systems. And B, like some companies and some industries are already trying this, Chris, and look at the opposition they're running into, not because, oh, we don't want to use AI, but because it's not as effective as everyone thought. And when I say it's not as effective, like it's not 100% effective, it's like 92% effective. And that 8% is worth hundreds of billions of dollars and requires people to stay employed. So it's still very effective and very helpful, but it's not a detriment, and it's not going to wipe out an entire layer of white collar workers that can be like, oh, this doesn't exist anymore.
All right. Well, we'll have to check back in at episode number 400. and speaking, this is, I don't know the exact number this one will end up, but I talked to our editor and the next one that me and you do together will be 300. So
I love it.
Bring your mini bottle of champagne.
We'll do it. Crack one open.
Yeah. Awesome. And if you're still listening, thanks for letting me and Matt rant every week, because we enjoy getting together like this. So
we're happy. Happy to do so. Yeah. And thanks everyone for listening. Chris, I'll talk to you next week.
All right, sir. Take care.
See ya.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake, with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.